Strangers fell back out of the way to let me pass, hands to mouths, their faces frozen with... What was it? Fear?
No, no, keep away. Don't touch me, please. Don't let them touch me.
The voice was coming from Harriet's boudoir. I threw open the door. Dogger was crouched in a corner, one of his quivering hands clasping the wrist of the other in front of his face.
Please, he whimpered.
Leave him alone, I shouted at his ghosts. Get out of here, leave him alone.
And then I slammed the door loudly. I stood perfectly still and waited until I could bear it no more. About 10 seconds, I think. And then I said, It's all right, Dogger. They're gone. I've sent them away. It's all right. Dogger trembled behind his hands, his face, the colour of ashes, looking up at me, unseeing. It had been months, half a year, perhaps, since he had suffered a full-blown episode of such terror, and I knew that this time it was going to take a while. I walked slowly to the window and stood gazing out through a wreath of frost. To the left, in the steadily falling snow, the lorries of Ilium Films were almost hidden beneath the thick white blanket, as if, at the end of the darkening day, they were tucked in for a winter's sleep. Behind me, Dogger let out a pitiful little whimper.
It's snowing again, I said. Fancy that.
In the stillness, I could almost hear the falling flakes.
Isn't it a wonder, with that number of snowflakes, that no one has ever thought to write a book called The Chemistry of Snow?
There was silence behind me, but I did not turn round.
Just think, Dogger, of all those atoms of hydrogen and oxygen joining hands and dancing ring around a rosy to form a six-sided snowflake. Sometimes they form around a particle of dust. It says so in the encyclopedia. And because of it, the form is misshapen. Hunchbacked snowflakes. Fancy that.
He stirred a little, and so I continued. Think of the billions of trillions of snowflakes and the billions of trillions of hydrogen and oxygen molecules in every single one of them. It makes you wonder, doesn't it? Who wrote the laws for the wind and the rain, the snow and the dew? I've tried to work it out, but it makes my head spin. I could see Dogger reflected three times over in the triple looking glass on Harriet's dressing table as he struggled slowly to his feet, and stood at last with his hands dangling limply at his side. I turned away from the window and, taking one of his hands, led him, shambling, to Harriet's canopied and ruffled bed.
Sit down here, I said, just for a minute.
Surprisingly, Dogger obeyed and dropped down heavily onto the edge of the bed. I had thought he would balk at the very idea of taking a seat in Father's shrine to Harriet. But the fact that he did not was probably due to his confusion of mind.
Put your feet up, I told him, while I gather my thoughts.
I piled a mound of snowy pillows at his back. With glacially slow speed, Dogger eased himself back until at last he was reclining in what looked, at least, like a comfortable position.
Stiff water, we could call it, I said. The book, I mean.
Yes, that would probably have more appeal.
Stiff water. I quite like that.
I expect some people would buy it, thinking it was a detective novel. But that's all right. We wouldn't care, would we? But Dogger was already asleep, his chest rising and falling in gentle swells, and if the tiny crease at the corner of his mouth was not the seed of a smile, it was, perhaps, a lessening of his distress. I covered him to the chin with an afghan and returned to the window, and there, for what might have been an eternity, I stood staring out into the gathering gloom, into the cold, blowing universes of hydrogen and oxygen. Chapter 10.
At 5:30, the people of Bishop's Lacey began to arrive. First were the Misses Puddock, Lavinia and Aurelia, the proprietresses of the St. Nicholas Tea Room. Incredibly, these two creaking relics had walked the mile through deep drifts of snow, and now their round faces glowed like little red furnaces.
"We didn't want to be late, so we set out early," Miss Lavinia said, looking round appreciatively at the decorated foyer. "Very, very swank, isn't it, Aurelia?"
I knew that they were sizing up the situation, sniffing out the possibilities of being asked to perform. The Mrs. Puddock had managed to insinuate themselves into every public performance in Bishop's Lacey since the year dot, and I knew that at this very moment, stuffed handily somewhere into the depths of Miss Lavinia's handbag, would be the sheet music for Napoleon's Last Charge, Bendemeer's Stream, and Annie Laurie, at the very least.
"It's not for an hour and a half yet," I told them, "but you're welcome to have a seat. May I take your coats?"
With Dogger out of action, I had decided to take over the duties of the doorman myself. I'd certainly had enough practice during the day. Father would be furious, of course, but I knew that he would thank me when he came to understand. Well, perhaps not thank me, but at least spare me one of his 3-hour lectures. But for now, Father was nowhere in sight. It was as if, having received payment for the use of Buckshaw, he had no further obligation. Or could it be, perhaps, that he was ashamed to show his face? The film crew were putting the finishing touches to the improvised stage, adjusting the lights and moving tall basketwork trumpets of fresh flowers into position at each side of the make-believe courtyard, when the doorbell rang. Bunching my sweater tightly round my shoulders, I opened the door to find myself nearly nose to nose with a complete stranger. He was wrapped in a khaki greatcoat with no insignia that I was quite sure must have been issued by some army or another. He was short, with freckles, and was chewing gum the way a horse chews an apple.
"This Buckshaw?" he asked.
I admitted that it was.
"I'm Carl," he announced. "You can tell your big sister I'm here."
"Carl? Big sister?" Of course! This was Carl from St. Louis, Missouri. Carl, the American, who had given Feely the chewing gum I had pilfered from her lingerie drawer. Carl, who had told her she was the spitting image of Elizabeth Taylor in National Velvet. Carl, who had taught her how to spell Mississippi.
There had been Americans, I recalled, who had shared the airfield with the Spitfire squadron at Leithcote, a few of whom, like Dieter, had chosen to remain in England at the end of the war, and Carl must be one of them. He was holding a small package, almost completely hidden inside a thicket of green ribbon, hung all over with red and white candy cane decorations.
"Camel?"
he asked, producing a packet of cigarettes at his fingertips and cleverly flipping it open at the same time with his thumb, like a conjurer's trick.
"No, thank you," I said. "Father doesn't allow smoking in the house."
"He doesn't, eh? Well, then I reckon I'll hold my fire for a spell. Tell Ophelia, Carl Pendraka is here, and he's ready to boogie-woogie."
"Good Lord!"
Carl sauntered past me into the foyer.
"Say," he said. "Swell place you got here. Looks like they're making a movie, am I right?
Do you know what? I saw Clark Gable once in St. Louis, in Spiegel's. Spiegel's is where this came from."
He gave the gift a shake.
"My mom picked him up for me, stuck him in with the camels. Clark Gable looked right at me that time in Spiegel's. What do you say to that?"
"I'll tell my sister you're here," I said.
"Feely," I said, at the door of the drawing room. "Carl Pendraka is here, and he's ready to boogie-woogie."
Father looked up from the pages of his London philatelist.
"Show him in," he said.
The imp inside me grinned and hugged itself in anticipation. I went only as far as the end of the corridor and beckoned Carl with a forefinger curled and uncurled. He came obediently.
"Nice place you've got here," he said, touching the dark panelling appreciatively.
I held open the study door, doing my best to mimic Dogger in his valet role, a look on my face and a particular posture that indicated keen interest and at the same time keen disinterest.
"Carl Pendracker,"
I announced, a trifle facetiously. Feely looked up from her own to Carl's reflection in the looking glass as Carl walked briskly to where Father sat, seized his hand, and gave it a jolly good wringing. Although he didn't show it, I could tell that Father was taken aback. Even Daffy glanced up from her book at the breach of manners.
"Carl's family might be related to the King Arthur Pendragons," Feely said in that brittle and snotty voice she uses for genealogical discussion.
To his credit, Father did not look terrifically impressed.
"Merry Christmas, Miss Ophelia Deluce," Carl said, handing her his gift.
I could tell that Feely was torn between centuries of good breeding and the urge to rip into the gift like a lion into a Christian.
"Go ahead, open it," Carl urged. "It's for you."
Father subsided quickly into his stamp journal, while Daffy, pretending to have reached a particularly gripping passage in Bleak House, was secretly peering out from beneath her furrowed brows. Feely picked at the bows and ribbons as slowly and as fussily as a naturalist dissecting a butterfly under a microscope with tweezers.
"Tear it off!" I wanted to shout. "That's what wrapping's for!"
"I don't want to spoil this beautiful paper," she simpered.
"By the buttons of the Holy Ghost, I could have strangled her with the ribbon."
Carl obviously felt the same way.
"Here," he said,
taking the package away from Feely and poking his thumbs through the folded paper at the ends.
"All the way from St. Louis, Mo, the Show Me State."
A candy cane clattered to the hearth.
"Oh," said Feely as the wrapping fell away. "Nylons, how lovely. Wherever did you find them?"
Even Daffy gasped. Nylons were as scarce as unicorn droppings. The holy grail of gift-giving. Father shot up out of his chair as if on a spring. In a flash, he was across the room and the nylons, which he had ripped from Feely's hands, were dangling from his wrists like adders.
"This is outrageous, young man. Positively indecent. How dare you?"
He brushed the stockings off his hands and arms and into the fireplace. I watched as the nylon shriveled, writhing and blackening in the flames, transformed by heat into their constituent chemicals. Adipoyl chloride, I knew, and hexamethyl anhydiamine. I felt a little shiver of pleasure as the stockings gave up the ghost in one last, delicious, flickering flame. Their dying breath, a wisp of the deadly poisonous gas, hydrogen cyanide, floated up the chimney, and then it was gone. In just a few seconds, Carl's gift was no more than a sticky black glob bubbling on the Yule logs.
I don't understand," Carl said.
He stood looking from Father to Feely to Daffy to me.
"You limeys are crackers," he said, "just plain ditzo."
"Ditzo," Carl repeated to me in the foyer, shaking his head in disbelief. Feely had fled, shaken by sobs, to her bedroom, and Father, in a thundercloud of outraged dignity, had taken refuge in his study.
"Have a chair," I said, and, as the doorbell rang again, I introduced Carl quickly to the Mrs. Puddock.
"Carl's from St. Louis in America," I told them, and by the time I reached the door, they were already chatting away like lifelong cronies. On the doorstep, as if for inspection, was Ned Cropper, gift in hand and brilliantine in hair. A few steps behind him stood Mary Stoker. Aside from her ruddy complexion and a bit of a squint, Mary might have been a Madonna in the National Gallery as she stood on the doorstep, radiant in the snow.
"No room at the inn," I thought uncharitably.
"Ned! Mary!" I crowed a little too cheerfully.
Ned was the potboy at the 13 Drakes, Bishop Slacy's sole hostelry, and Mary was the landlord's daughter. I knew without being told that Ned had brought the gift for Feely. another box of those fly-blown, pre-war milady chocolates from the window of Miss Cool's confectionery, its contents lightly frosted with a mould which could, of course, if you had a strong enough stomach, be scraped away before scoffing them. Ned's love tributes were generally left on the kitchen doorstep in the dark of the moon to be brought in dangling distastefully between finger and thumb by Mrs. Mullet.
"Them tomcats been around again," she would mutter.
"I like your hair," I said to Mary. "Did you get it cut?"
"Cut it myself, special for Christmas," she whispered. "Do you like it, really?"
"Nobody's going to give Phyllis Wyvern a second look with you in the room," I said, giving her arm a squeeze. "Oh, you!" she laughed and slapped my hand a little harder than she knew.
"Find a seat," I told them. "You're early, so you can take your pick."
I knew that Ned would choose front row centre, and I was right. He'd want to be as close to Phyllis Wyvern as was humanly possible. A roaring motor in the forecourt announced that Dieter had arrived with the first load of audience. I threw open the door just as the Fergie jerked to a stop, its headlamps making cornucopias of foggy yellow light in the falling snow. Behind the tractor, brimming over with passengers, a couple of village men perched precariously on the runners, was Harriet Slay. A shadow passed in front of my heart. How sad it was to think that somewhere Harriet should have died in snow like this. How could such tragedy occur amid such beauty? That was the way with ghosts, though. They appeared at the strangest of times, in the most peculiar places. I hadn't long to call my mother's face to mind. People were already piling out of the sleigh and coming towards the door, laughing and talking excitedly.
"Flavia! Halloo, mon vieux! Joyeux Noël!"
That was Maximilian Brock, the pint-sized concert pianist, retired, who had traded his keyboard and bench for a whole new career as the village gossip mill. It was whispered, but not by me, that he wrote up and sold as fiction to the romance magazines the thinly disguised tales of door-latch scandal he had gleaned in Bishop's Lacey.
"Lust sheets," Daffy called them.
"Have you seen Phyllis Wyvern yet?"
Max demanded.
"How does she look in life? Are her wrinkles as parched gullies, or was that sheer meanness on the part of Tittle-Tattle?"
"Hello, Max," I said. "Yes, I've seen her, and she's never been more lovely."
"And those sisters of yours? Still growing?"
"You can ask them yourself," I said, somewhat impatiently. "Once Max got started, you might as well put down roots." But before he could frame another question, Max was nudged aside by the substantial tummy of Bunny Spurling of Nautilus Old Hall, looking so much like Mr. Pickwick that it gave me the momentary creeps. His thumbs hooked tightly in his waistcoat pockets, Bunny patted his stomach and raised his pink nostrils into the air as if he were on the scent of food.
"Flavia,"
he said, not putting too much effort into it before scurrying away on curiously dainty feet. After the sleigh had emptied, Dieter made a tight circle with the tractor and sleigh in the snowy forecourt, and with the wave of a mitt, jounced off to the village for another load. With Dogger out of commission, I was kept busy welcoming newcomers and chatting up old acquaintances. It was evident that no one else in my family was going to put in an appearance. They had obviously decided that the evening's performance was the business of the filmmakers, and that there was no need for them to lift a finger. I was on my own. Not long before starting time, the vicar arrived, huffing and puffing in the foyer and stamping his feet.
"It's coming down as if all the angels and archangels are plucking chickens," he said.
Cynthia hung back, scowling at his blasphemy.
"Constable Linnet tells me that all roads in and out of Bishop's Lacey are hopelessly blocked," he went on, "and are likely to remain so until the Hindley roadmen clear their own turf. It's the price we pay for being outlanders, so to speak, but nevertheless it's dashed inconvenient."
Marion Trod came squeezing herself through the hubbub.
"Miss Wyvern is ready, Vicar," she said, "if you'd be so kind."
Of course, my dear, tell her I shall preface her performance with a few remarks of my own, re-roofing fund, etc., and then it's all hers. Oh, and Mr. Duncan's, of course. Dear me, we mustn't forget Mr. Duncan. As the vicar made his way to the front, Father, Feely, and Daffy, led by Aunt Felicity, filed slowly into the foyer and took their seats in the front row. Since Ned was occupying the chair that should have been mine, I stayed in the back. I twiddled my fingers at Nia, and she twiddled back, tapping her tummy and rolling her eyes comically. "Ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbours, and anyone else I've managed to leave out." There was a polite titter to reward the vicar for his sparkling wit. "We've all of us braved the roaring elements tonight to illustrate the wise old saw that charity begins at home. If we now find ourselves warm and cozy in the ancestral home of the family de Luce, it is entirely due to the kind graces of Colonel Haviland de Luce. Hear, hear! That we are able to come together in such inclement weather to prop up the roof of St. Tancred's, as it were. Without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Miss Phyllis Wyvern and Mr. Desmond Duncan. Miss Wyvern, it is unnecessary to tell you, is a star of stage and screen who has thrilled all of our hearts in such productions as Whitehall Nelly, The Secret Summer, Love and Blood, The Glass Heart. He paused to pull a scrap of paper from his pocket, clean his spectacles with it, and then read what was written on it. The Crossing Keeper's Daughter, The Trench in the Drawing Room, The Queen of Love, Sadie Thompson, a couple of nervous titters and a distinctly wolfish whistle, and last but not least, The Rector's Wife. This was greeted by general cheers but marred by a single catcall. Cynthia sat staring straight ahead, her lips pursed. "Mr. Duncan has been seen most recently in Articles of War, and so without further ado, we welcome to Bishop's Lacey two great luminaries of the screen, Miss Phyllis Wyvern, ably assisted by Mr. Desmond Duncan, in their world-famous interpretation of a scene from William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet." There was no curtain to go up, but in its place the lights were switched out, and for a few moments we sat in the dark. Then a spotlight pierced the blackness, picking out a little grove of potted lemon trees. A lettered placard on a wooden tripod told us that this was Capulet's orchard. I twisted round far enough to see that the fierce white beam of light was coming from atop the scaffolding above the door, and that the figure hunched over one of the snouted spotlights was Gil Crawford. Romeo, in the form of Desmond Duncan, came strolling into the grove to a smattering of applause. He was dressed in tan tights, over which was a peculiar pair of red velvet shorts, which looked rather like inflated swimming trunks. He wore a white shirt of the peasant variety, all fancy ruffles of lace at the neck and sleeves, and his sporty flat hat was decorated with a pheasant's tail feather. He extended his open hands to the audience and took a series of elaborate little bows before speaking his first word. "Come on," I thought, "get on with it." "He jests at scars that never felt a wound." Another pause and another sprinkling of applause in recognition of that famous voice. "But soft, what light through yonder window breaks?" A few sparse hand claps to show that they were familiar with the line. "It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. Arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon." Again he paused, gazing up, his eyes fixed on Juliet's balcony, which remained, beyond the spotlight's beam, in utter blackness. "Spot!" Phyllis Wyvern's voice commanded loudly from somewhere above Romeo's head. The moment was frozen. It seemed to stretch on and on. "Arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon," Desmond Duncan began again, still not quite Romeo. "You could have heard a pin drop in China." "Spotlight, damn it!"
snapped the voice of the fair Juliet from the darkness, and there came from behind me the most frightful crash, as if some metal object had fallen from the scaffold onto the tiles of the foyer.
"The envious moon," Desmond Duncan ploughed on, "who is already sick and pale with grief, that thou, her maid, art far more fair than she."
There was a sudden rustling of silks as Phyllis Wyvern came swishing down the steps from the landing, her feet appearing first at the perimeter of Romeo's spotlight, and then her dress. Her costume was absolutely gorgeous, a fawn-coloured creation, wide at the hem, tight as blazes at the waist, and shockingly low at the neck. The precious stones that lined the collar and sleeves glittered madly as she passed through the glare of Romeo's spotlight, and a gasp went up from the audience at the unaccustomed splendour that had materialised so suddenly in their midst. Into her braided hair was woven a chaplet of flowers, real flowers by the look of them, and I bit my lip in admiration. How young and beautiful, and how timeless she seemed. The real Juliet, if ever there was one, would have spit in envy. Down and down she came, and at last onto the foyer floor, her pointed slippers making a menacing sound on the tiles, like a pair of snakes tiptoeing on their rib ends. Ned Cropper shrank back a little as she swept past him towards the front door. "She's leaving," I thought. "She's walking out." I twisted round in my chair, fighting to remain seated, as Phyllis Wyvern, having reached the scaffolding, seized hold of the ladder, placed a delicately slippered foot on the first rung, and began to climb. Up and up she went, her Elizabethan dress, even in the darkness, shooting off sparks of light like a comet ascending the heavens. At the top, she stepped off onto the plank flooring and edged her way along to where Gil Crawford stood watching her approach, his mouth open. Clinging to the scaffold's railing with one hand, Phyllis Wyvern hauled off and, with the other, slapped Gil hard across the face. The sharp crack of it echoed back and forth across the foyer, refusing to die. Gil's hand flew to his cheek, and even in the near darkness, I saw the flash from the whites of his terrified eyes. She hitched up the hem of her dress and manoeuvred back to the ladder, which she managed to climb down with surprising grace. Looking neither to the right nor the left, Phyllis Wyvern processed. There's no other word for it. She looked as if she were walking in state up the centre aisle of Westminster Abbey. She processed across the foyer to the foot of the west staircase, which she climbed, skirt still hitched in one hand, to the landing, where she turned and struck a pose at the railing of her make-believe bedroom balcony. After a heart-stopping pause, the second spotlight came on with an audible clack, catching her in its beam like some exotic moth. She clasped her hands to her breast, took a shuddering breath, and spoke her first line.
"Ay me," she said.
"She speaks," said Romeo.
"Oh, speak again, bright angel," he went on rather hesitantly.
"For thou art as glorious to this night, being o'er my head, as a winged messenger of heaven, unto the white upturned wondering eyes of mortals that fall back to gaze on him."
I couldn't help thinking of Gil Crawford's eyes.
"Oh, Romeo, Romeo," she cooed, "wherefore art thou Romeo?"
And so on. The rest of the performance was just a lot of that moon, June, balloon stuff, a load of old mulch, really, and I found myself wishing they had chosen a more exciting scene from the play. One of those involving toxicology, for instance, which are the only really decent parts of Romeo and Juliet. We had been made to listen to the play in its entirety on one of Father's compulsory Thursday wireless nights, during which I had formed the opinion that while Shakespeare was good with words, he knew beans about poisons. The difference between poisons and narcotics seems to have escaped him, and he was in an utter muddle when it came to those vegetable and mineral irritants that act upon the brain and spinal cord. In spite of all the wordy hocus-pocus about gathering herbs by moonlight, Juliet's symptoms indicated the use of nothing more mystifying than plain old hydrocyanic acid administered in drinking water. Forever and ever, amen. By now, Phyllis Wyvern and Desmond Duncan were taking their bows. Joining hands like Hansel and Gretel, they took a couple of steps towards the audience, then backed away, and then advanced again like waves lapping at the sands. Flushed with pleasure, or something, they were both perspiring freely, their makeup, at close range, suddenly ghastly in the overhead lights. Phyllis Wyvern was so close to Ned that his mouth gaped open like a flounder on a fishmonger's stall, so that Mary had to nudge him in the ribs. I looked up just in time to catch a glimpse of a dark figure vanishing into the shadows at the head of the stairs, just above Juliet's makeshift balcony. It was Dogger, and I realized with a start that he had been there all along. Chapter 11. With the foyer lights switched back on, I had my first chance to have a glance round at the entire audience. There in the back row, with a happy look on his face, sat Dieter. Beside him, chewing on a mint, was Dr. Darby, and behind him, Mrs. Mullet with her husband, Alf. Each of them seemed caught up in a trance, blinking round in silly wonder, as if they were surprised to find themselves still in their same old bodies. Theatre, I suppose, is a form of mass mesmerism, and if that's the case, Shakespeare, despite his chemical shortcomings, was surely one of the greatest hypnotists who ever lived. I had seen a spell woven before my eyes, broken by a slap, then woven again as easily as a granny darns a sock. It was marvellous, a blooming wonder, actually, when you came to think about it. The actors had now gone to remove their makeup, and the cine crew vanished to the upper reaches of the house to do whatever they do after a performance. They had not stayed to mingle with the audience, but that, perhaps, was part of the spell. A gust of cold rushed suddenly into the foyer. Someone had opened the front door for a breath of fresh air. Given a gasp, cries had gone up, and now everyone, including me, was crowding for a look outside. A sharp wind had arisen during the performance and piled a waist-deep snowdrift at the door. It was easy enough to see that tractor or no tractor, sleigh or no sleigh, no one was going to get home to Bishop's Lacey tonight. Still, Dieter was brave enough to give it a try. Bundling up in his heavy coat and scaling the white mountain that had appeared so suddenly, he was soon lost in the darkness. "Better ring up Tom McGully to bring his snowplough," someone said.
"No use doing that," came a voice from the far corner, "as I'm already here."
A nervous laugh went up as Tom came forward and peered out the door with the rest of us.
"It's a mort o' snow," he said, somehow making it official. "A mighty mort o' snow."
The hands of several ladies flew to their throats. The men exchanged quick glances, their faces expressionless. 10 minutes later, Dieter was back, caked with the stuff, shaking his head.
"Tractor doesn't start," he announced. "Battery's dead."
The vicar, as usual, had taken charge.
"Ring up Bert Archer at the garage," he had told Cynthia. "Tell him to bring his wrecker.
If you can't get through to Bert, leave a message with Nettie Runciman at the exchange."
Cynthia nodded grimly and plodded off towards the telephone.
"Mrs. Mullet, I saw her here somewhere. Mrs. Mullet, do you think it would be possible to lay on some tea and perhaps some cocoa for the little ones?"
Mrs. Mullet made for the kitchen, happy to be one of the first enlisted. As she vanished into the passageway, Cynthia reappeared.
"The line is dead," she announced in a monotone.
"Well then," the vicar said, "as it seems we're here for the duration, we shall just have to make do, shan't we?"
It was decided with surprisingly little fuss that preference would be given to those with children who would be allowed, wherever room permitted, to bunk in among the cine crew who had already been assigned digs on the first floor. Somewhere during the process,
Father had put in a brief appearance, and with a couple of pointed fingers and a few words to the vicar, had mobilized the operation as if it were a precision military exercise. He had then re-vanished into his study. Those who could not be accommodated upstairs would bunk down in the foyer. Pillows and blankets that had not been used since Harriet was alive would be brought out of their storage presses and handed out to the makeshift refugees.
"It shall be just like old times," the vicar told them, rubbing his hands together vigorously. "Not unlike the bomb shelters during the war. We shall make a great success of it, a grand adventure. After all, it isn't as if we haven't done it before."
There was more than a trace of Winston Churchill in his voice. The vicar organized a few games for the children: Puss in the Corner, Blind Man's Buff, Hide and Go Seek, with prizes donated by Dr. Darby, mints of course, to the winners. The grown-ups gossiped and laughed quietly on the sidelines. After a while, the more boisterous activities dwindled to guessing games. As the evening wore on, the false jollity subsided. Yawns appeared, stifled at first, but eventually becoming open, and damn the niceties. Children began to doze off, and their parents soon followed. It wasn't long before most of the displaced villagers of Bishop's Lacey were in the grips of sleep. Later, as I lay snuggled beneath my eiderdown, alone in the vast, barn-like coldness of the east wing, I could hear, for a while, the muted buzz of conversation, like the hum of a distant hive. After a time, this too died down, and my ears detected only an occasional cough. It had been a long, long day, but in spite of it, I couldn't sleep. In my mind, I saw the bundled bodies scattered helter-skelter in the foyer, sleeping mounds beneath their blankets like so many tussocks in a country churchyard. I tossed and turned for what seemed like hours, but it was no use. Surely everyone was asleep by now, and nobody would be disturbed if I crept to the top of the stairs and took a peek. With the very real threat of Father losing his battle with the taxman, I was now consciously saving up images for a time when I was an old lady, a time when I would rummage through my recollections of Buckshaw as one might turn the pages of a dusty photograph album. "Ah, yes," I would quaver in my old woman's voice. "I mind the time we were snowed in on Christmas Eve, the winter night that Bishop's Lacey came to Buckshaw." I climbed out of bed and into my refrigerated clothing. Down the corridor I crept, stopping now and then to listen. Nothing. I stood at the top of the stairs, looking down upon the makeshift shelter. Perhaps because it was so close to Christmas, there was something oddly touching about those huddled forms, as if I were an aviator, or an angel, or God even, looking down from above upon all of these helpless sleeping humans. From somewhere far away, in the west wing, came the sound of distant music and of unreal recorded voices. So profound was the silence in the house that I was even able to make out the words. "I shall never forget Hawkhover Castle." Phyllis Wyvern was watching herself on film again. The music swelled and then died. Downstairs, someone rolled over and began to snore. From where I stood, I could see Dieter, bundled against the railing on the landing. Smart enough to choose a higher sleeping place, I thought, where the air is slightly warmer and the flooring not so cold as the tiles of the foyer. In the hall below, Mrs. Mullet breathed heavily, her arm draped as casually over Alf as the babes in the wood. Slowly, I descended the staircase, taking special care to tiptoe past the sleeping Dieter. Over there, against the wall, was Cynthia Richardson, in sleep as relaxed as an archangel on a Christmas card, her face like Flora in the Botticelli painting. I wished I'd had a camera so that I could preserve that unexpected glimpse of her forever. At her side, the vicar slept, his brow deeply furrowed. "Hannah, please!"
"No,"
he whispered, and for a moment I thought that he had awakened. "Who is Hannah?" I wondered,
And why was she tormenting him in his sleep? Upstairs, a door closed softly.
Phyllis Wyvern, I thought. She's finished for the night with her viewing.
A marvellous idea floated into my mind.
Why not see if she wanted to talk? Perhaps, like me, she was sleepless.
Well, what if she was lonely?
We could have a nice chat about grisly murders.
Being so famous probably meant that all her friends were in it for the money, or the glory, for being able to say they were chummy with Phyllis Wyvern. She'd have no one to talk to about the things that really counted. Besides, it would probably be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to have a world-famous movie star all to myself, even if only for a few minutes. But wait. What if she was tired? What if she still hadn't got over that fierce outburst when she'd slapped Gil Crawford's face? Would she do the same to me? I could almost feel the sting of her hand on my cheek. Still, if I told Feely I'd spent an hour or so idly chit-chatting with Phyllis Wyvern, she'd be sick jealous. That settled it. From the bottom of the stairs, I set out on tiptoe across the foyer, picking a precarious and winding path between the sleeping bodies. While I was still in the midst of the encampment and halfway to the west staircase, a water closet flushed. I froze. It was an unpleasant fact of life at Buckshaw that the rickety maze of pipes that passed for plumbing had seen far, far better days. They were, in fact, past their prime when Queen Victoria was on the throne, if one may be permitted to say such a thing. A flush here or a water faucet activated there transmitted vast shudders and groans to the farthest corners of the house like some bizarre hydraulic signalling system from another age. To put it plainly, no one at Buckshaw had any secrets, not at least in the plumbing department. I stopped breathing until the shudder of pipes subsided in a far distant clatter. Ned, who was propped up against a wall with his feet splayed out like a cast-off doll, gave a groan, and Mary, whose head was on his knees, turned over in her sleep. I counted to 100, just to be sure, and again began picking my way between the sleeping bodies. Up the west staircase I went, one step at a time, counting them as I climbed. 10 to the landing, another 10 to the top corridor. I knew that the 13th tread from the bottom groaned alarmingly, and I took a giant step to climb over it in silence, hauling myself up by gripping the banister. Past the top of the stairs, the corridor was in darkness, and I had to feel my way along by sense of touch. The baize door to the north front swung open without a sound. This was the part of the house that had been assigned as billets, the dusty sheets that usually covered the furniture having been removed, and the multitude of bedrooms made ready for the visiting film crew. I had no idea which bedroom had ultimately been allocated to Phyllis Wyvern, but common sense told me that it would have been the largest, the blue bedroom, the one usually occupied by Aunt Felicity on her ceremonial visits. A crack of light at the bottom of the door told me that I was right. Inside, something mechanical was running. A whirring, a whine, hardly louder than a whisper. Slap, 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 slap. What on earth could it be? I tapped lightly on the door with one of my fingernails. There was no reply. Inside the room, the noise went on. Slap, 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 slap. Perhaps she hadn't heard me. I knocked again, this time with my knuckles.
Miss Wyvern, I whispered at the door. Are you awake? It's me, Flavia.
Still no response. I knelt down and tried to peer through the keyhole, but something was blocking my view. Almost certainly the key. As I got to my feet, I stumbled in the darkness and fell against the door, which in awful silence swung inward. On the far side of the room stood the great canopied bed, made up and turned down, but unoccupied. To the left, on a tubular stand in the shadows, a cine projector ground on and on, its steady white beam illuminating the surface of a tripod screen on the far side of the room. Although the film had run completely through the machine, its loose end, like a black bullwhip, was still flapping round and round. Slap, 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 slap. Phyllis Wyvern was slumped in a wing-back chair, her sightless eyes staring intently at the glare of the blank screen. Around her throat, like a necklace of death, was a length of cinefilm, tied tightly, but neatly, in an elaborate black bow. She was dead, of course. Chapter 12. In my 11 years of life, I've seen a number of corpses. Each of them was interesting in a different way, and this one was no exception. Because the others had been men, Phyllis Wyvern was the first dead female I had ever seen, and as such, she was, I thought, deserving of particular attention. I noticed at once the way the illuminated cine screen was reflected in her eyeballs, giving the illusion for a moment that she was still alive, her eyes sparkling. But even though the eyes had not yet begun to cloud over, she's not been dead for long, I thought, something had already begun to soften her features, as if her face were being sanded down for repainting. The skin was already on its way to taking on the colour of putty, and there was a very faint but distinct leaden tinge to the inside of her lips, which were opened slightly, revealing the tips of her perfect teeth. A few drops of foamy saliva were trapped in each corner of her mouth. She was no longer wearing her Juliet costume, but was dressed rather in an elaborately stitched Eastern European peasant blouse with a shawl and a voluminous skirt. "Miss Wyvern," I whispered, even though I knew it was pointless. Still, there's always that feeling that a dead person is playing a practical joke and is going to leap up at any moment and shout boo and frighten you out of your wits. And my nerves, although strong, are not quite ready for that. From what I had read and heard, I knew that in cases of sudden death, the authorities, either police or medical, were to be summoned at once. Cynthia Richardson had reported that the telephone was out of order, so the police, at least for the time being, were out of the picture, and Dr. Darby was in a deep sleep downstairs. I had seen him during my passage across the foyer. There was no question that Phyllis Wyvern was past medical help, so my decision was an easy one. I would call Dogger. Closing the bedroom door quietly behind me, I retraced my steps through the house, on tiptoe across the foyer once again to Dogger's little room at the top of the kitchen stairs. I gave three quick taps at the door, and then a pause, two more taps, another pause, and then two slow ones. I had scarcely finished when the door swung open on silent hinges and Dogger stood there in his dressing gown.
"Are you all right?" I asked.
"Quite all right," Dogger said after a barely perceptible pause. "Thank you for asking."
"Something horrid has happened to Phyllis Wyvern," I told him, "in the blue bedroom."
"I see."
Dogger nodded and vanished for a moment into the shadows of his room, and when he returned, he was wearing a pair of spectacles. I must have gaped a little, since I had never known him to use them before. The two of us, Dogger and I, made our way silently back upstairs by the quickest route, the foyer, which involved yet another trek among the sleeping bodies. If the moment hadn't been so serious, I'd have laughed at Dogger's long legs picking their way like a wading heron between Bunny Spearling's distended stomach and the outflung arm of Miss Aurelia Puddock. Back in the blue bedroom, I closed the door behind us. Since my fingerprints were on the handle anyway, it wouldn't make any difference. The projector was still making its unnerving flap-flapping noise as Dogger walked slowly round Phyllis Wyvern's body, squatting to look into each of her ears and each of her eyes. It was obvious that he was saving the bow of cinefilm around her neck for last.
"What do you think?" I asked finally, in a whisper.
"Strangulation," he said. "Look here."
He produced a cotton handkerchief from his pocket and used it to pull down one of her lower eyelids, revealing a number of red spots on the inner surface.
Petechiae, he said. Tardieu spots. Asphyxia through rapid strangulation. Definitely.
Now he turned his attention to the black bow of film that ringed the throat, and a frown crossed his face.
What is it, Dogger?
One would expect more bruising, he said. It does not occur invariably, but in this case, one would definitely expect more bruising.
I leaned in for a closer look and saw that Dogger was right. There was remarkably little discoloration. The film itself was black against Phyllis Wyvern's pale neck, the image on many of its frames clearly visible. A close-up shot of the actress herself in ruffled peasant blouse against a dramatic mackerel sky. The realization hit me like a hammer.
Dogger, I whispered. This blouse, shawl and skirt, it's the same costume she's wearing in the film.
Dogger, who was looking reflectively at the body, his hand to his chin, nodded. For a few moments, there was a strange quiet between us. Until now, it had been as if we were friends, but suddenly, at this particular moment, it felt as if we had become colleagues, perhaps even partners. Possibly, I was emboldened by the night, although it might have been a sense of something more. A strange feeling of timelessness hung in the room.
You've done this before, haven't you? I asked suddenly.
Yes, Miss Flavia, Dogger said. Many times.
I had always felt that Dogger was no stranger to dead bodies. He had, after all, survived more than 2 years in a Japanese prisoner of war camp, after which he had been put to work for more than a year on the notorious death railway in Burma, any single day of which would have given him more than a nodding acquaintance with death. Aside from Mrs. Mullet's whispered tales in the kitchen, I knew little about Dogger's military service, or, for that matter, my father's. Once, as I watched Dogger trim the rose bushes on the visto, I had tried to question him.
You and Father were in the army together, weren't you? I asked, in so casual and off-handed a manner that I hated myself for having bungled it before I even began.
Yes, miss, Dogger had said, but there are things which must not be spoken of.
Even to me, I wanted to ask.
I wanted him to say, especially to you, or something like that. Something I could mull over deliciously in the midnight hours. But he did not. He simply reached among the thorns and, with a couple of precision snips, dead-headed the last of the dying roses.
Dogger was like that. His loyalty to Father could sometimes be infuriating.
I think, he was saying, you'd best slip down and awaken Dr. Darby, if you wouldn't mind, of course.
Of course, I said, and letting myself out, made for the stairs. To my surprise, Dr. Darby was not where I had last seen him. The spot where he had rested was empty, and he was nowhere in sight. As I wondered what to do, the doctor appeared from beneath the stairs.
Telephone's bust, he said, as if to himself. Wanted to call Queenie and let her know I'm still respirating.
Queenie was Dr. Darby's wife, whose terrible arthritis had confined her to a wheelchair.
Yes, Mrs. Richardson tried to use it last night. Don't you remember?
Of course I do, he said snappishly. It's just that I'd forgotten.
Dogger has asked if you'd mind coming upstairs, I said, taking care not to give out any details in case one of the sleepers might be listening to us with their eyes closed.
He'd like your advice.
Lead on, then, Dr. Darby said, with surprisingly little reluctance. Amid the encircling gloom, he added, extracting his first mint of the day from his waistcoat pocket. I led the way upstairs to the blue bedroom, where Dogger was still crouched beside the corpse.
Ah, Arthur, Dr. Darby said, again I find you on the scene.
Dogger looked from one of us to the other with something like a smile, and then he was gone. "We better be having the police," Dr. Darby said, after making the same examination of Phyllis Wyvern's eyes that Dogger had already done. He felt one of the limp wrists and applied his thumb to the angle of the jaw.
Is life extinct, Doctor?
I asked. I had heard the phrase on a wireless program about Philip Odell, the private eye, and thought it sounded much more professional than, is she dead? I knew that she was, of course, but I like to have my own observations confirmed by a professional.
Yes, Dr. Darby said, she's dead.
You better roust out that German chap. Dieter, is it? He looks as if he'd be good with skis. 15 minutes later, I was in the coach house with Dieter, helping him strap the skis to his boots.
Did these belong to your mother? He asked.
I don't know, I said. I suppose so.
They are very good skis, he said.
Mud shoes. In Norway they were made.
Someone has looked after them.
It must have been father, I thought. He came here sometimes to sit in Harry's